Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Lunch Therapy. I'm your host, unlicensed lunch therapist Adam Roberts. Just wanted to give you a little update. Since we last spoke, I have moved from Los Angeles to Brooklyn, New York. That's why I've been gone for 3 weeks. We had to pack up our apartment. We had to spend 2 weeks while the moving truck went across the country, and then we had to unpack, and now we're all settled in and things are going great. I even unpacked my microphone, which is why this sounds so good. And I wanted to welcome you to a whole new season of Lunch Therapy. You know, now that it's after Labor Day, we are kicking off a whole new string of episodes. And my first guest back is Leah Koenig, the author of the brand new Roman Jewish cookbook, Portico. She's an accomplished food writer with 7 cookbooks under her name, including The Jewish Cookbook and Modern Jewish Cooking. In today's episode, we talk about the influence of the Jewish people on Roman cuisine.
Roman Jewish food evolved at the same time that Roman food evolved.
What she learned cooking with Jewish Romans for her book.
I had like 6 people telling me, you know, the soup is ready when you can see the layer of olive oil glistening on the top.
And keeping kosher at home.
But you also can't have like a chicken schnitzel with a side of like feta and tomato salad, as delicious as that is.
And just so you know, I recorded this episode with her right before I left Los Angeles. So if I talk about packing up and all that stuff, that's why. All right, without further ado, here is my Lunch Therapy episode with Leah Koenig. All right, Leah. Well, it's so nice to meet you. Congratulations on your brand new cookbook. How does it feel to have it out in the world?
Thanks so much. It is wonderful. This is my 7th cookbook. And wow. I honestly feel like each one feels as thrilling as the last. So
it's funny. I had a holiday party once, or a Hanukkah party, and my friend Marcos got me the little book of Jewish appetizers, or the book of little Jewish appetizers. And I didn't put that together that that was your book. So when I was researching you for this podcast, I was like, oh my God, I already have another of her books. So that's incredible. So what's motivated you to keep writing cookbooks? Because I've done a few and it's a lot of work and you don't get that rich doing it.
That is true. honestly, I think it really kind of is a good match for the type of weirdo that I am. I love developing recipes. I love the kind of mix of part science and part, you know, kind of creative process that is involved with that. And I love keeping spreadsheets and like, you know, I'm very like organized in that way, which can be annoying for people around me sometimes when I'm like, wait, what's our plan? What are we doing? But yeah, I think cookbooks really just are a wonderful way to explore the world and to really deep dive. I mean, so much of what we see in food media these days is like quick little snippets and like, you know, quick recipes, and that's great. And there's a place for that. But cookbooks just offer you this chance to really take a deep dive and learn more about yourself and more about what you're studying. So yeah.
Well, also, I mean, like you, it's funny because I accidentally insulted one of my last guests. I won't say who, but I was like, oh, your book that you just wrote was like a vacation. And she's like, it wasn't a vacation. It was a lot of work. But it's like, but with your book, it's like, okay, you got to go to Rome and experience all this incredible Jewish food that is made in Rome. I mean, to me, that is like the dreamiest job in the world, but I don't want to be insulting about it. But it sounds like it was a lot of fun to do.
It was incredible. I mean, the funny part is that I pitched the book to my agent and the publisher, Norton, who's a great publisher. If you ever have a chance to work with them, I highly recommend it.
I just worked with them on my Broadway cookbook, but it was a division of Norton, which is Countryman Press. So gotcha. Under the umbrella of Norton. But yeah, they liked the idea.
Yeah, but I pitched it during the like depths of the early pandemic. And the idea was originally sort of, you know, everybody was wanting to armchair travel at that point. So I had been to Rome a million times prior and have a lot of like deep connections to that. You know, I did my own little like eat, pray, love.
I need to do a trip to Rome. I'm so jealous, but keep going.
Yeah. Well, except I went when like in the depths of my early 20s, you know, despair of being brokenhearted at the time and like existential angst and all of that. So I don't necessarily recommend going under those circumstances. But that means that most of my research for the first kind of almost year of this book was done over Zoom. So I would like Zoom with a chef or Zoom with a home cook and like go in their kitchen virtually and watch them make stuff, but it's just not the same as actually going there. And it was September of 2021. It was kind of like post-Delta, pre-Omicron. It's such a weird way to classify it.
Yeah, that's a very specific way, but that's good. I remember that period. Yeah.
Yeah, the world felt kind of open and free. And I, you know, booked a trip with the photographer, Kristen Teague, who's amazing. And she and I traveled to Rome, and I got to like see a lot of people that I had made connections with over Zoom. And it just really brought the whole thing to life in this amazing way. And all the smells and the sights. And I went to dinner at one of my friend's homes, who features heavily in the book, Michaela. She's a tour guide there and is wonderful. And she had a copy of a cookbook, a Roman Jewish cookbook, that I had only seen online. And like, to be able to hold it in my hands, and like, I was trembling. It was just
what
like,
what was it? What's the name of the book?
It is called, it's like, basically it translates to like In My Kitchen. It was published in the 1980s by this wonderful woman whose name is escaping me, but I could pull it up for you.
Oh, that's okay. No. Let's just say people have Google. They'll find it.
Yeah. Or I can send it to you for like liner or show notes or whatever.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
But yeah, it was just like wonderful to be able to actually see a lot of things and make connections in person.
Well, it's funny because I traveled to Rome with my family like when I was in high school, and that's the last time I was there, which is crazy because I'm in my 40s. But we went to the Jewish ghetto, and I remember my dad started singing Elvis's song in the ghetto, which was really inappropriate.
But I think he's the only person who's done that.
But you know, it's funny because I've only recently become aware of how culinarily rich that part of Roman culture is. I mean, especially the artichokes, like, and all this stuff. So can you talk a little bit about the Jewish contribution to Roman cuisine and why this area is so fascinating to you and why you wrote this book about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Rome's Jewish history goes back 2,000 years. The original kind of Jews who came from ancient Judea came as emissaries of Judah the Maccabee. So if you know the Hanukkah story, you've heard the Maccabee before. So they were basically fleeing Greek tyrant, you know, the Greek tyrants in ancient Judea, and found refuge in Rome. And they were the first ones there. And there are still some people who claim that their families go back to the time of, you know, Caesar, and go back to ancient Roman times. And the community has really existed continuously since then. And over the years, other groups have come. For example, after the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal, Sephardi Jews moved there. And what's interesting, among other places, Turkey, Greece, North Africa, Italy, was Rome was one of the places they moved. And what's interesting about it is, at the time, Sicily and parts of southern what we now call Italy, were actually ruled by Spain, right? Because Italy wasn't a unified country until 1871. So all the rules of the Inquisition, which basically said Jews had to either convert to Catholicism, leave, or be murdered, all great options, right? all of those rules applied to the Jews of Sicily as well. So you had a lot of Jews from Sicily migrating north to Rome also. That's why in Roman cuisine, you see, you know, things like pine nuts and raisins. And
I was just going to say pine nuts and raisins immediately came to mind when you said that, because I've made like a Sicilian pasta with like sardines and pine nuts and raisins. So I guess that makes a lot of sense. And it's also in Jewish cuisine too, like raisins and challah and stuff. Okay. Wow.
Totally. Yeah. Although there's not a lick of Ashkenazi, like Eastern European cuisine in Roman cuisine. There is in Northern Italy, which more borders like Germany and France, you do find some of that, but Rome is not Ashkenazi at all. And then in the 1960s, like after the Six-Day War in Israel, Jews had to basically leave all Arabic-speaking countries. So at that point, a bunch of Jews from several thousand Jews from Libya immigrated to Rome. Okay. So today you have this like amazing patchwork of a unified Jewish community, only about 17,000 people, like not a big community, with ancient Italian, Sephardi, and now kind of like a little bit of Libyan influence all mixed together. And so I tried to capture that in the book. But in terms of your question about like their influence, Roman Jews' influence on Roman cuisine, you can't overstate it, because Roman Jewish food evolved at the same time that Roman food evolved, right? Mm. Like, so a lot of these ancient dishes, you can't really tell if they're Roman or if they're Jewish or if they're both. And there's a lot of dishes that are identified as either a la Judea, Judea, which is like Jewish style, or a la Romana, which is Roman style. Mm.
And there's a lot of example? Overlap. Like, what's an example of a dish that would go one way or the other way?
There's a lot of like, well, a lot of the fried dishes, people, so the like Fritto Misto, for example, which is like, you know, Italian tempura, basically.
Right. Yeah.
That is originally a Roman Jewish dish that came about in the ghetto because, like many places where, you know, Jews have lived, they were persecuted, for a long time. And, you know, Jews had to live in the ghetto from the 1550s to the 1871, which is a really long time. It's like 300 years of being forced to live in this tiny, cramped, flood prone, you know, neighborhood, which looks nothing today like it used to. In the 20th century, it was basically like razed to the ground and like rebuilt with wider streets. And they made like a ledge so that the Tiber River wouldn't flood into it like it used to. Like, it's basically a different place. But what was I saying? Oh, so during the ghetto period, Jews were basically not allowed to have most professions. And one major kind of exception to that is they were allowed to basically be street vendors. And so a lot of Jews would sell, they were frigatory. So they would sell fried foods, and they fried everything, like all sorts of vegetables, little fish, fried, they would mozzarella balls, like they would just sell that on the street. And they call Fritto Misto pizzetti, or little pieces, which I love. I think it's a much more like interesting name. So that's a dish that we think of as Roman or Italian, and it's very much stems from the Jewish community.
Well, it makes me think a little bit about oil too, and like the connection between, like, you were talking about Judah Maccabee and frying things in oil, but also like to fry things in oil feels like kind of an indulgence. Like, if you were very poor and impoverished, to be able to afford the amount of oil to fry all that food in. So it makes me wonder, like, were they just using the same oil throughout the day and frying it over and over again?
They probably were, but the two interesting things about that is, one, most Roman Jewish homes didn't have ovens at the time, because that was a luxury. Like, there was no, you know, there were no kind of hearths or ovens. So a lot of stuff was done on a fire or some kind of stove top that they had at the time. And you have to remember that they were in Italy, which is like the source of olive oil, right? Or one of the many places where olive oil is abundant. And so actually it was a fairly economical way of cooking. We think of it as like, you know, I'm going to go get imported Greek or Italian olive oil. It's going to be $25 a bottle. But for them, it was actually accessible and plentiful. And yeah,
that's good. Okay, well, now, Leah, we are going to turn the tables now. We are going to put the spotlight on you, and not just the Jewish people of Rome. And so I'm going to ask you today, what did you have for lunch?
Today's lunch was kind of a triumph in leftover cooking.
Okay.
I'm a freelancer. I've been freelancing since 2009. So I feel like I've kind of perfected the like quick but not sad desk lunch. So we had some leftover rotisserie chicken, which always a good thing to have.
Right.
And we had some leftover bell peppers because we had folks over, we had friends over the weekend, and I made like a crudité platter. So I had some leftover of those. So I actually kind of made like a very inspired by but not traditional fajita situation. I sauteed the peppers and some onions over really high heat, and then, like, you know, cut the chicken into strips and added that at the end. And then I took some flour tortillas and I, like, you know, flipped them on the burner till they were singed.
Love doing that. That's so fun.
And like so quick, right? You don't have to.
I know. And I feel bad for my friends who are transferring from gas burners to, you know, the conduction burners, because it's like, that's better for the environment, but it's like, not, you can't singe a tortilla on a conduction.
You can't.
Conduction. Is that the right word?
Induction.
Whatever those ones are. Yeah. Okay. That sounds delicious. Were you cooking just for yourself, or were you cooking for your family, or?
My kids are both away at camp for the day. So I mean, I have to go pick them up at 3:30, but you know.
Okay. How old are your kids?
My son is almost 9. He'll be 9 this month. And my daughter is 4. Yeah.
Got it. And do they love your home cooking?
Oh, no, they're both so picky. They're
so
picky.
I hear that a lot from my friends who cook. Yeah.
I think my son is better than he used to be. But my daughter, like I definitely was one of those parents who was like, I'm not going to cater to their needs. But the Jewish mother in me is like, I'm not going to let my kids go hungry. Like, you want Cheez-Its and mozzarella? Fine. Just fill your belly. Yeah. But no, today I was cooking for me and my husband, who's also a freelancer.
I'm in the same boat. Yeah, we do that too here. But yeah, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say, we recently moved and congratulations on your upcoming move. It looks amazing.
Thank you. Wait, are you in Brooklyn or are you in Manhattan?
We're in Brooklyn. Yeah. And we just moved in December. So I guess it's a while ago now, but it still feels new. And we have a little like terrace for the first time. So I'm getting to kind of practice having a green thumb for the first time in my life. And we have tomatoes outside and we have this little like tiered herb situation. So I picked some lemon balm and some basil to put on the fajitas. And
oh my God, you're gonna have to come over because we have a terrace in our new place too. We kind of went a little overboard with this new apartment. Like we had a budget, like let's say the budget was like from 1 to 5 and we went to like 8. So like we're like, okay, now we are in big trouble, but it has a terrace and a nice kitchen. We'll probably only get to live there for a year before we go bankrupt, but you can help me. I will have the opportunity to grow things and herbs. So
it makes such a big difference for like mental health. I mean, just being able to go outside and like putter for a few minutes with green stuff is really wonderful.
So wait, where in Brooklyn, if you don't mind my asking?
Yeah. So I have lived in New York since 2004. So almost 20 years. Wow. And have lived in all Brooklyn that time, Park Slope, Prospect Heights, most recently Kensington for 8 years, which is south of Prospect Park. And we just moved a little further south, which is how we were able to manage getting a 3-bedroom, which we needed for the kids. We're in kind of the border of Kensington and Midwood, which is a really fascinating neighborhood because it's part really Orthodox Jews and part like little Pakistan. So I mean, the food shopping is amazing. The community, the people walking around, that they're lovely, and it's just really it's a nice place to be.
Well, that's a good transition into my question about your Jewishness, because, I'm Jewish. I don't know if you could tell. in terms of food, like I am such a oddball to my parents who like watch me cook on my Instagram. They're like, what are you making? And like the biggest trouble I ever got into with my mother, maybe in my entire life, was the day that I made bagel bombs, which are like those like, orbs of bagel with like cream cheese inside. And I was making them on my Instagram. She goes, what? And she called me in the middle. She's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm making bagel bombs. She goes, it's Passover. And I completely forgotten that it was Passover. And so like, that's how bad a Jew I am. But in terms of your Jewish identity and food, how did the two things connect? And why did that become your shtick, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I grew up in suburban Chicago. My mom is Jewish. My dad was not Jewish. And so our household was Jewish. Like, we didn't do the Christmas and Hanukkah thing. We only did Hanukkah, and we went to synagogue, and I had a bat mitzvah. And so I had a connection to my dad's family, and like we would sometimes go to my half sister's house for celebrating Christmas with them, but like our family was just Jewish. So, you know, my mom is a really good cook, and she, you know, was one of those people who shopped at the farmer's market before it was cool. And, we always had real maple syrup and not like pancake syrup, and, no shade to anyone who loves pancake syrup, but, she kind of like really valued quality ingredients in the 80s and 90s before it was cool. And she made a decent amount of Jewish food for the holidays. She would make, brisket for Rosh Hashanah, and she made amazing potato latkes, like the ones that my cookbook is basically stealing her recipe, because I've never had better ones. And we would make hamantaschen for Purim, and she made amazing chicken soup and matzo ball. So a lot of the like Eastern European, Central European classics.
Interesting that you had a good cook doing that though, because it's so funny when you talk about like brisket and you talk about humitash, and I think about like dried out brisket that like overcooked in the oven, or like dry crumbly humitash from like the bakery that's been sitting there for 12 days. So it sounds like you had really good versions of all of that, which is nice.
Yeah. Oh, there is so much bad Ashkenazi food out there. Like, yeah. I don't know what happened. I think it was, I'm going to blame like, you know, the 1940s and like everybody all of a sudden wanting to use like Crisco and like crappy ingredients and stuff.
But, right.
No, she made like, her brisket was never dry. Yeah. It was saucy and delicious and whatever. So that is what I grew up, you know, knowing is Jewish food. And when I started to write, I started to write in 2009, and I was an environmental studies major in college and like really into like sustainability and farming and all of that. So I kind of thought that I was going to go the route of being like a farming, agriculture, sustainability food writer, because food was always, you know, that part was clear for me. Mm-hmm. But I guess the like adage of write what you know just kind of made sense for me. And I started to explore like the stories behind the foods that I had grown up with. And like, I was just curious, like, why do we put poppy seeds and humintash in, and, you know, why potatoes on Hanukkah? And it's, mm-hmm. when you think about it, it's literally like, because there was nothing else to eat in the middle of winter in Eastern Europe. You had mm-hmm. apples for applesauce and you had potatoes for so it's totally a seasonal thing. But you can only write about Ashkenazi food for so long before you start to wonder about, you know, other parts of Jewish food life. So,
and was your family Ashkenazi background? Was that like,
yeah,
sort of,
okay. Yeah, my mom's side is like Russian Lithuanian, and my mm-hmm. dad's side is not Jewish but German, so there's actually a lot of overlap in terms sure. of like dumplings and whatever.
Yeah, my whole family is Russian Jew, so I think that's almost exclusively Ashkenazi, but
yeah Ashkenazi is anything like Central and Eastern Europe. Okay. But yeah, I started to like be interested in the food from Spain and Turkey and, you know, Jews who live in North Africa and, you know, Jews who live in further flung places like India or Ethiopia, or like,
cause really? There's,
yeah, Jews have lived and cooked pretty much everywhere in the entire world. Maybe not Antarctica. I don't know if there's ever been like a Shabbat dinner on Antarctica.
That's your next book. That's, you got to pitch that right now. It would
probably be a short book, but, but yeah, so the more I learned, it just felt like Jewish food became this wonderful prism through which to explore the world more mm-hmm. broadly, since a lot of the places that, you know, Jews cooked and lived, they were eating the foods of their neighbors and mm-hmm. and adapting them to make them, you know, kosher, you know, not using pork or whatever, and, you know, finding ways to make things that fit their food needs. So yeah.
And in terms of your own cooking, to bring it back to the fajitas, are you a kosher cook? Are you will you cook with bacon? Will you cook with bacon fat, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. So I did not grow up keeping kosher. You know, my household was pretty open. My mom made a lot of like shrimp and crab, and we would have like surf and turf for New Year's Eve and things like that. But my husband grew up Orthodox. So he grew up totally kosher. Like when we first met, he wouldn't eat in restaurants that didn't have kosher certification. I remember it was like a big deal that he would eat with me at a vegan restaurant that didn't have kosher certification. Mm. That felt like a stretch. And you know, we've been together since 2006. So that's a long time now.
Exactly the same as me and my husband, literally 2006. Cool. Yeah.
Wow. That's really great. Long relationships are yeah. cool.
You get to know someone. Years. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Oh my God. I hadn't put that number on it, but wow. yeah. So, you know, over time we've kind of found a happy medium. So at this point, our kitchen is kosher. So yeah. like, I don't cook, anything that's not kosher in our mm-hmm. kitchen. And that's partially because, you know, my in-laws keep kosher and I want them to be able to feel comfortable eating at our house. And hospitality is like a, you know, important to me.
And what about the whole, because my dad grew up in a kosher home. And so he talked a lot about the different sets of plates and different things like that. So can you talk a little bit for people who don't know Well, I mean, I don't know if you do this, but like, do you do the separate sets of plates for dairy and meat,
Yeah. One of the kind of foundational kosher laws is that you don't mix milk and meat. And there's different interpretations of what that means. But the kind of standard one is that, you know, you wouldn't serve meat and milk dishes at the same meal. You certainly wouldn't make like a lasagna with meat in it. You'd make a vegetarian lasagna. So you weren't mixing meat and cheese, but you also can't have like a chicken schnitzel with a side of like feta and tomato salad, as delicious as that is.
Right. And do you do that for yourself ever, or you just don't do it?
So at home we don't, and we do have a set of meat dishes and a set of dairy dishes, and we keep everything separate. But out in the world at restaurants, as someone who writes professionally about food and wants to experience the world of food, I am more flexible. I draw the line at pork and shellfish. So I don't eat any pork or bacon or ham or anything or any shellfish out of the house, but I will eat like non-kosher meat that's not certified, and like I'll eat at any restaurant and that kind of thing. Yeah.
It's funny because my dad, when I grew up, he hated cheese. Like we really never had cheese at home. And so like when I went to my friend's house for the first time, his mom served lasagna and it was like meat and cheese bubble. I never made that connection that I think maybe part of that was just because how he grew up, that just there wasn't. But now it's like my husband is not Jewish at all. And like his favorite thing in the world is cheese. So like, it's like he won't eat a hamburger unless it is a cheeseburger, and he won't eat a lasagna unless there's tons of cheese. So it's like, I kind of went the other direction, but I'm curious for you with your childhood, did you grow up eating non-kosher food, or did you always sort of maintain sort of a version of this?
No, my mom cooked pretty much everything. She would not, I don't remember her cooking pork in the house. Maybe once she made pork chops, but like, I don't remember that being part of our house. But yeah, like I was saying, like shrimp and seafood and that we definitely had, and she did not buy kosher certified meat or anything like that. Oh, and when we would go out like to eat, my brother was allowed to order bacon because he was obsessed with bacon. And so my mom was always like, I'm not going to have bacon in the house. She didn't like the way it smelled. I think there's like a visceral thing back in her bones from like having kosher grandparents and stuff where it didn't, but she's like, you can have bacon. So he would, no matter what he was ordering at a restaurant, there was a side of bacon. So.
Well, it's funny because also like there's a Jewish loophole, which is Chinese food, which I think is a Seinfeld episode, but I go with my parents to, you know, the Palace of Wong on Long Island. And we would have like, you know, pork wontons and like my mom would get like shrimp and lobster sauce. Is that what it was called? Like all kind. I guess that's not, well, no, that was shrimp. I mean, like they would just eat all kinds of I mean, now they eat everything, but I always felt like Chinese food was the funny little free pass that you would get as a Jewish person.
Yeah. If you kept really strictly kosher, you wouldn't, but there were a lot of people who were kind of like, if I can't tell what it is and it's chopped up really small or it's inside an egg roll, then I'm not going to ask. So yeah.
So to bring it back to your lunch. So you had, oh my God, the people upstairs are moving. So I don't know if you could hear like things dropping on the floor. Hopefully that's not making it into the podcast. But yeah, the fajitas, I didn't notice this when you mentioned it, but there's no cheese in your fajitas, but like would a traditional fajita probably would have had cheese, right? And the chicken.
Probably like cotija or like some kind of crumbled white cheese. Yeah. What I did do, I feel like the secret kind of creamy component for a lot of people who keep kosher is mayo, right? Mm. Like, you know, tuna salad, egg salad, like there's a lot of like mayo heavy dishes in certain parts of Jewish cuisine. So I took mayonnaise and I actually have it. I know you can't see it, but I have this hot sauce called Uncle Yankee's tropical pepper sauce, which I'm obsessed with because it's like not too spicy, but it has such great, like kind of almost fruity flavor. So I mixed the mayo and the hot sauce together and I spread that on the bottom. So there was like a creamy element, but because there's no dairy and mayo, it's you're allowed to have it.
By the way, when you said mayonnaise, I felt like I heard your Midwestern accent come through a little bit.
I, not on purpose, but I have mostly lost my Midwestern accent along the way, but it comes out in certain words. So it's very likely that you did. Yeah.
Sorry. I hope I'm not embarrassing you.
Out. No, not at all. Not at all.
Well, that's really fascinating. So how do you, I mean, this is getting personal. So again, like we can shift back to Jewish heritage, but in terms of like being married to someone who's kosher, you talked about the restaurants of it all and living in a city as wonderful and exciting as New York. how do you manage it in your marriage when you like hear about this like amazing new, you know, seafood restaurant? I mean, I guess you don't eat seafood yourself, right?
Yeah, that's true. But right.
I guess I'm asking, like, as a food lover in New York City, how do you manage your ability to experience new restaurants and new places that open up?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, my husband is flexible. He will eat at other restaurants and he's more flexible. So that's not really an issue. I mean, menus, you can always find something that's sure. good. But early on in our relationship, it was really hard, especially when we traveled together, because, you know, food, like, why travel if you're not going to experience the food of the place that you're going? Mm-hmm. And so I remember there was one trip we took together to New Orleans, which, I mean, it's like, that's like the least kosher friendly place in the world. Oh,
yeah.
Like crawfish and
All that stuff.
Yeah. Muffalata, jambalaya, like none of that is anywhere close to kosher. And I'm sure it's different now, but 15 years ago when we went, there were like, I think there was one vegan restaurant in all of New Orleans.
There's the Jewish one, Shaya. Was that there when you were there?
No, that wasn't there yet.
When I was just there and it was delicious. It was like hummus and all that stuff, but it was like a New Orleans spin on all of it. So
right. Yeah. Oh, I love Alon Tal. Alon Tal, right? Is the chef, I think.
I think his last name is Shaya. I think
Alon Shaya. Yeah. I don't know where I'm getting Tal from. Okay. I'm mixing two people together, but yeah, I love Alon Shaya. But so we went and we were like trying to find a restaurant where we could eat and we couldn't find one. The only place we were able to eat was, we were able to get beignets from Cafe du Monde because they had actually, a local rabbi had certified them because all they serve are beignets and the chicory coffee. So there's like really no chance of it being not kosher. Mm-hmm. But I remember just being kind of bummed and like, we had a great time and we biked all around and like went to the French Quarter and everything. But I really felt like that bit was missing. So, I think at this point we found a happy medium and it doesn't really hold me back anymore to try things out.
What about for your kids? Do they feel like at school, like if somebody's eating like a ham and cheese sandwich kind of stuff, like do they get jealous or do they not care or do they?
I don't think either of them really have experienced anything negative. I think Max, my 9-year-old, Bee's too little. She's 4. So she's just like, and she's super picky. So she could eat mac and cheese every day and be fine.
Right.
But I think Max at one point said, I think I'm curious to try bacon at some point. And honestly, I don't care. That's his choice. For me, it's like, you know, we have come to what we do in our household as a family. But like, if he wants to try something, I'm not going to stop him from doing that.
That's great. So, I think that's really nice. Well, instead of focusing on the negative aspect of keeping kosher, maybe we could focus on the positive sides, which are the sort of ritualistic connections between food and family and history and culture. So, I mean, in your home, do you do Shabbat? Do you do these traditions? And how do you bring your knowledge of making delicious food into these traditions? Like, do you put little twists on them? Do you, do all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, you know, just to sort of answer a side question, and then I'll get back to that. Like, you know, in the work that I do, which is kind of exploring the world of Jewish cuisine all around the world, like the one thing, like a Shabbat dinner and a Moroccan Jewish table and a Shabbat dinner on, an Ashkenazi Jewish table are going to be totally different. The dishes are different. Even some of the ways that like the blessings are made are different. But there is such a line of continuity between like why you're at the table and like this special feeling of like being with family and taking time out of your week to actually just like be and not to be like creating anything, just like existing. And that is a through line through every, Jewish community I've ever explored or like, researched. And to quickly bring it back to Portico, the Roman Jewish book, Yoshi and I went to Rome for our honeymoon and we got invited to a kosher caterer who lives there, Giovanni, to his house for Shabbat dinner. And I was a vegetarian at the time. I was a vegetarian for 10 years from like 17 to 27.
Okay.
And, I was kind of like ready and curious to try not being a vegetarian, but I still was like solidly not eating meat. And we show up at his house and the table literally is covered in meat dishes. It was like, you know, there was stracotto, which is like the a wine braised beef, kind of like a pot roast or beef stew. And there was this amazing, like they have a dish that's made with like chicken and veal meatballs with celery.
I saw that in your book. Sauce. Yeah, I was looking at that. That looks delicious.
It's so good. It's so good. And like just all meat dishes. And I turned to Yoshi and I was like, if the phrase when in Rome ever applies, like it's tonight, I'm going to eat everything. And I ate right. everything. And it was so great. But what I remember even more about that meal was just that, like, we were complete strangers when we walked in, and because we were all there to celebrate Shabbat, and we kind of knew we all had, like, we knew how to bless the wine and the bread and light the candles together. Like, we left as friends in this really kind of profound way, which is what you want from any meal. But like, yeah. So for me, like, bringing that sense of joy of Shabbat into our family's household is really important. And, you know, we try to do Shabbat dinner every week if we can.
Well, it's funny because when you were just saying all this, it made me think of just Italian food and Italian families and things like The Sopranos and shows where, like, you see them all sitting around the table. And it's like, my family has always been obsessed with Italian food, to the point where I would almost go as far as to say, like, we've eaten a lot more Italian food as a family than we have as eating Jewish food as a family. And so, like, to me, there's something really fascinating about that marriage that you have been able to, like, focus on between Italian cuisine and Jewish cuisine, because there's so many similarities between the two cultural groups. It's like 100%. My mom and her friends and their hair, and like a bunch of Italian women and their hair. It's like you would not be from the back, you would not be able to tell them apart. So I mean, I love that there's this like connection. And so, you know, in terms of your interest in Italian food, when did that start developing for you?
Yeah, I would say it was on that same trip, that same honeymoon trip. I first went to Rome when I was 22, whenever I graduated college. And that was like, you know, it was a brief stop in Rome on my way to Tuscany, where I worked on a vineyard for the summer, which was,
wow.
Oh my That's God. So cool. Like, yeah. so amazing. 10 out of 10 recommend for anyone in their early 20s. I couldn't run off and do that now, but
it was actually funny, because when we were looking at apartments, one of the apartments we looked at was in Park Slope. And it was kind of, you know, it was like a fine apartment. It wasn't great, but the backyard was huge and they were growing grapes in the backyard.
Wow.
Just like vines and, you know, I was like, what am I going to do with this? Like, yeah. I'd have to like learn how to make wine or something.
Yeah. Or grape jelly. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so I stopped in Rome on that trip. I was traveling by myself and, you know, doing like the hostel life and whatever. And I made the briefest of trips into the Jewish ghetto because I had kind of heard about it, and I just was too young and I just didn't connect with it at all. Like, beyond just like, oh, this exists. But by the time I came back 5 years later with Yoshi, or 6 years or whatever it was, I was really into Jewish food at that point and like kind of beginning my journey of being like a professional food writer. And that trip, I would say, in many ways, like, solidified that was the work I wanted to do, because I was like, okay, I know about Ashkenazi Eastern European Jewish food, and I know a little bit about Sephardi food from, you know, traditionally from Spain and Portugal. And I even know about like Mizrahi or Middle Eastern, you know, Jewish food, but I had never heard of fried artichokes, like whole fried artichokes, or these amazing fruit and nut bar cookies called pizza abreka, or like Jewish style pie, basically, that are sold in this little bake shop. And all these dishes that I was trying were totally new to me. And it just exploded my understanding of what Jewish food was. And it just completely expanded my sense of the world. And so in some ways, like, my love of Jewish food, and particularly Roman Jewish food, started on that trip, but it also like very much informed the work I did more broadly, because I realized just how interesting, like, I could keep exploring forever and keep uncovering new dishes and new parts of the world. So
that's interesting. It's funny, because I just had Anya von Bremzen on the podcast, and she wrote this book, National Dish.
Great book.
Which is all about like how cultures embrace, like Italians embrace pizza as their national dish, and Japanese embrace ramen as a national dish, but what the truth is behind it. And so it's making me wonder, as you're talking about the Jewish contribution to Italian cuisine, and with the rise of anti-Semitism around the world right now, has there been any pushback to Jews claiming, you know, the origins of certain dishes. Like, I mean, fried artichokes, I know, are so associated with the Jewish community. But like, as you worked on this book, were there any dishes that you wanted to claim as a Jewish dish that some Italians would be like, that's not Jewish, that's Italian?
Interestingly, I think Italy doesn't, like, I think Rome acknowledges how ancient the community is. And so, mm-hmm, I think a lot of people will say, like, you know, well, first of all, Roman people, just like Italians everywhere, like, are very proprietary about, mm-hmm, and like, the way their grandma does the dish is the best way. And if your grandma, right, adds oregano or basil instead of rosemary, like, she's an idiot. And like, you know, I actually, mm-hmm, like, I saw a fight break out between two elder Jews in the Roman Jewish ghetto over how to trim an artichoke. Like, they literally were like, almost came to blows and were like pointing at each other, like, no, you're doing it wrong. They're like, that's the, so like, there is a lot of that, but there was an openness where a lot of people were like, oh yeah, like, of course that dish probably has Jewish roots. And so it didn't really come up as much as you might expect.
So with this book, Portico, first of all, can you tell people, I mean, I read the introduction, but for those who haven't read it yet, why is it called Portico?
Yeah. So Portico, if you just translate it, kind of means like entrance or front porch. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so at one edge of the Roman Jewish ghetto, there's a ancient ruin called Portico de Ottavia. Okay. And my Italian is, you know, I'm studying it, but I don't have a great accent, so apologies in advance.
Sounded great. I love it.
So this is an ancient ruin that goes back to the time of, you know, Caesar and Augustus. And over the years has been many different things, but for a very long time, like hundreds of years, including the 300 plus years that Jews lived in the ghetto, it was a fish market. Mm. So it basically was like an open air fish market. Can you imagine what that must have smelled like in the summer?
Not
I can't
good.
Even. Right. So that was a very important place for Roman Jews to get, you know, fish and to basically like one of their main sources of sustenance. Although interestingly, Roman Jews were not allowed to buy the big fish. There was a marble measuring slab. And if the fish, the head and the tail flopped over either side of the measuring slab, they were not allowed to buy that fish. It was too big. So that is why you see a lot of sardines and anchovies and small fish in Roman Jewish cuisine, because they were only allowed to eat those things. Yeah.
Makes me think of like the smoked fish that we have, like white fish and stuff. Like, I wonder if that's all the same kind of idea.
I think there's a Jewish, universal Jewish love of fish. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
But so that, it, you know, that ruin is still there today. And it's just kind of looms over the streets of the Roman ghetto. So it kind of feels like the entrance to the ghetto. Mm-hmm. So I just thought, as one of the most important kind of physical structures of the Roman ghetto, like, I felt like that would be a great title. And then I also just love that the word portico means like front porch. So it's like an entry into the book and an entry into the cuisine.
So what surprised you when you were working on this? I mean, what dishes did you encounter that you were like, whoa, I've never had that before, or I didn't know you could combine X and Y and Z and make something delicious?
Yeah, so many things. I mean, like much of Italian cooking, Roman Jewish cooking is pretty simple in that, or elemental, like it takes fresh ingredients, doesn't do all that much, douses a crap ton of olive oil on them, and like, it's the most delicious thing you've ever eaten. But I think the things that kind of stood out to me the most were some of the rice dishes. Like, there's this one, tortino de riso. It's like a rice pie where you basically like take parboiled rice and douse it in passata, or, you know, the tomato puree and olive oil and garlic and basil, and then you bake it. So it's not really like a sliceable pie. It's more of like a scoopable pie. But it is so good. And it's just like so flavorful. And I don't know what kind of like magical alchemy happens that very few ingredients turned into something really incredible, but that was definitely a surprise to me.
That sounds like the way that like pasta absorbs tomato sauce, like the way that the parboiled rice would soak in all that deliciousness that you would get.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Wow. That sounds delicious. It sounds like a Jewish Italian version of Tadig.
Yeah, similar. Yeah, except the crust isn't on the bottom that you flip. It's like, but you does get like kind of browned around the edges.
Okay.
And a lot of the desserts were really incredible. They have a lot of Sephardi influence. So there's a lot of like almond flour desserts, things
love
like
almonds and Jewish dessert, like almond cake. It's funny because I grew up loving rainbow cookies, which again is like in Jewish delis, but it's also basically an Italian cookie. So there's another crossover. But I didn't realize the reason I love them so much is because there's almond paste in the dough. And so when I first made an almond cake with almond paste, which is my favorite thing to make, it's like, it was divine. I was like, oh my God, I just love that almondy, like sugary pasty.
So good.
Flavor.
And like, yeah, adds such moisture. You say almond like a Long Island guy, by the way.
Wait, how do I say it? Almond?
Almond.
Almond. Well, it's so funny because Craig, my husband, says that I have certain words that I say with a thick New York accent, like orange.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of orange.
Yes.
And horrible instead of horrible. So, wow, I love that you called me out on it. But you've got mayonnaise. I've got almond.
Exactly.
Well, I was going to ask you? Oh, I was going to say, so at the very beginning of this conversation, you talked about writing cookbooks and liking to be organized and liking spreadsheets and stuff. So I did want to ask you, like, what is your process? How do you, when you're tackling a book as large as a subject as Jewish, Italian, Roman food, like, where do you begin and how do you go through the process of doing it?
Yeah. I mean, this book was a challenge for that, but the one I wrote before, the Jewish cookbook, which is 425 recipes of global Jewish cuisine, that was like, you know, the spreadsheets of all spreadsheets for that book. But basically what I do is I start with what I know, and I start kind of categorizing recipes that I know I need to include. And then I also have like a page of people I need to talk to, because, you know, I'm a journalist at heart. I'm not an expert. I'm obviously not Roman. I didn't grow up with these foods, but I'm a good enough journalist, I hope and think, that like I know how to find out and like who to ask. Mm-hmm. So I'll just start interviewing people and having them tell me their stories. And then I say, who should I talk to? And I follow that kind of trail. And I once heard, I can't remember who said this, but once you start hearing the same stories over and over again, you kind of know that you've covered your bases. Mm-hmm. When people start telling you the same thing, and you're like, I had like six people telling me, you know, the soup is ready when you can see the layer of olive oil glistening on the top. And I was like, okay, Roman Jews love olive oil. Okay. Got that.
That's great.
And I also, went and did a lot of like archival, like cookbook research. There's a lot of old Jewish cookbooks from Rome and from Italy, that I checked out and, made sure that I was kind of covering my bases, and also like things that maybe like people don't cook so much anymore, but I still wanted to call out and things like that.
So there's the gathering phase where you're gathering all this information and you're interviewing people. And then there's the testing phase, right? Where you're actually testing. So how do you go about that part of it?
It is a monastic process. I mean, you are it is you in your kitchen and your computer and like your little like notes section. So basically I approximate what I think a recipe is going to be based on other recipes I've read, based on conversations I've had, based on like just my own basic cooking knowledge, or ideally based on memories of a dish that I've eaten in the past. And then I try it and I tweak it and I try it and I tweak it. And sometimes you get it in one or two tries, and sometimes it takes 5, 6, 7 tries of the same dish before you you feel like you've kind of cracked the code. And mm-hmm. then you have to make it again to make sure it wasn't just a fluke. So it's a lot of work. And I am super fortunate that I kind of, over the years of my books, have cultivated a group of really amazing volunteers and friends who like want to help. And so what I'll do is I'll send out a list of recipes that I'm happy with what they taste like. And I say, okay, go forth, make them in your kitchens. Tell me like everything that didn't work. Tell me what you loved. And I get really great feedback that way. That's like great. People, you know, because everyone's kitchen is a little different. Their oven temperatures are different. Like, you know, their zester once that maybe is like a finer zest or a coarser zest. And like, that can make a big difference. So having that extra information is super, super helpful.
What about your family? Do they taste your food and give you feedback, your kids and your husband?
Yeah, my husband eats everything. He's actually a really bad critic though, because he just likes everything. So he'll be right. Like, this is great. And I'm like, yeah, but like, what can I do to fix it or like make it? He's like,
I was curious because the kosher rules of not putting cheese and meat together seem to reflect the Italian rule of thumb that you don't put cheese on fish, not necessarily meat. But did you, I've also heard that that rule changes based on where you are in Italy, that like in Southern Italy, where there's not a lot of dairy, that it's just, you wouldn't put cheese on fish necessarily, but in the North, like if they encounter fish and they have their cheese, they will. So did any of that kind of spill over into your research or into your testing?
Yeah, you don't find a lot of cheese on dishes. You often find Botarga, like the cured fish roe, kind of adding that like last minute umami, like you grate it over top of pasta. For people who don't like fish, I often would say like you can use Botarga or you can use like pecorino or Parmesan, but not both together. Like pick your umami savory flavor. But I'm trying to think, they all just need to try a tuna melt and then they change their tune immediately.
Yeah. But you wouldn't have a tuna melt, would you?
Yeah, for sure. Cause tuna is, funnily enough, fish is not considered meat in kosher laws. Fish is this middle section called parv, which means not meat, not dairy. So eggs and fish are both okay to eat with either.
What is the kosher rule about meat and fish based on? Is it Leviticus? Like thou shall not, like, my bar mitzvah was from Leviticus, but it was the leprosy section, which is not a great section. But Leviticus has all kinds of rules in it that obviously as a gay person, like it's like, okay, Leviticus, I have some questions about. Mm-hmm. But is that where the kosher laws come from?
The kosher laws do start in the Torah. There's an injunction against the actual words are don't cook a kid, meaning like a baby goat, in its mother's milk.
Sure.
And so that has over time been, you know, interpreted in a variety of ways to, you know, not combine milk and meat at all. And then there
Which
was
is
like
funny because there's that recipe that I've made where you actually cook a pork loin in milk with like garlic and all that stuff. I think it's Marcella Hazan, but keep going.
I'm sure it's delicious. I'm
it's
sure
really
it's
good.
Delicious.
Yeah. It's really, really good. Okay.
But yeah, so, you know, there was a time when like, it was a question whether chicken fell into that category. Was chicken like meat enough? And eventually, like, you can't have chicken and dairy at the same time either, but fish is considered not meat from a kosher perspective.
Wow,
so,
now I'm craving a tuna melt for lunch. So that's good to know. Well, Leah, this has been delightful. It flew by. Before we end, I do want to ask you, I always start every podcast with what did you have for lunch? But I always end with, what are you having for dinner tonight?
Oh God, I have no idea. We will probably do something very simple, some kind of like pasta that my kids will eat. And we have a giant watermelon that my husband brought home from the market. So I'll either make like feta and tomato, feta and watermelon situation, or maybe I'll just cut wedges for the kids, but probably nothing all that exciting.
Well, okay, I'm gonna
was more exciting.
Yeah, but okay, but if pasta, like when you make pasta for the whole family, like what, as the author of an Italian Jewish cookbook, like how do you make your pasta?
Well, what I like to do is to make a base that everyone will eat. So, you know, if I make spaghetti, I can pull some aside for the kids with just like butter and cheese or whatever. And then for my husband and I think we have some broccoli rabe in the fridge. So I'll probably like do some garlic and broccoli rabe. And if I'm keeping it vegetarian tonight, I probably will do like, you know, little chili flakes, but keep meat out of it. So probably will be something like that. Garlicky, oily.
Yeah. Now pasta is my favorite food. And that just that also made me hungry. And my family like loves pasta. Is there any like history, like in Jewish, because I know kugel is like a pasta dish, basically, but like, is there like a version of pasta that exists independent of Italy in Jewish cuisine? Does that make
independent
sense?
Independent of Italy?
Well, I'm saying like kind of like a doughy, like I don't know, like a kasha varnishkis, like I guess that's Ashkenazi.
Yeah.
Like, but does that stem from Italy, or like, was that its own thing?
That depends on like where you think pasta came from originally, right? Like some people say it came from China, and that's why like lokshen, which is the Yiddish word for noodles, sounds kind of like lo mein. Like they think there's some like, you know, but some people also think it then came to Italy, and then, you know, it became like, I don't know. There's a lot of different reasons, or there's a lot of different kind of understandings of where pasta kind of originated, but it definitely made its way to Ashkenazi cuisine, because you do see things like lokshen kugel, like noodle kugels. And in Hungarian Jewish cuisine, you see noodles with cabbage, which is delicious. It's one of my favorite things. And you see all sorts of dumplings that are kind of in like the gnocchi family, right? Like you see schliskis, which are a Hungarian gnocchi, basically, that you cook in breadcrumbs that are so good. So I think it's one of those things where like the exact who did it first is almost irrelevant at this point.
Well, maybe that's your next book.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. Well, Leah, thank you so much. Well, I'm excited to meet you in person when I get to New York, and we'll have to garden together. So
yes, that would be wonderful. Congrats on the new home.
Thanks, and congrats on your new book, and everyone should go out and buy it. So mazel tov, and I'll see you around New York.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, that's it for today's episode of Lunch Therapy. If you'd like to follow along with all my cooking adventures in New York, give me a follow at Amateur Gourmet on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. You can follow me on Facebook. Just search The Amateur Gourmet. And of course, you could subscribe to my newsletter, amateurgourmet.substack.com, where I recently answered the question, how do you eat all of this food and not weigh 200 pounds or 300 pounds? Anyway, check that out. All right, I'll see you back here next week. Take care, and don't forget to eat lunch.